You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and coming up, the problems governments have to address are more complex than ever. And in order to tackle them, our next guest will argue we need a new model of government altogether that brings us all together. But first, it's time for Wisconsin Life, and here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about family song traditions.
Many of us grow up singing our family's favorite songs. They can carry a deeper meaning if they're rooted in tradition. For writer Jen Rubin of Madison, she's fortunate to have recordings of her grandmother's songs, tapes that were recently called upon during a family crisis.
When I was a kid, we always had shelves filled with blank cassettes. Sony, Memorex, TDK. We had them all. They sat in nice stacks, just laying in wait for me when my grandma called for me to bring her a blank tape and the tape recorder. I dreaded this moment. One minute, I was splayed out on the couch watching sitcom reruns, and the next minute, I was sitting next to my 75-year-old grandmother and her boyfriend, Yaakov, recording them while they sang the Yiddish folk songs. Now, I loved listening to my grandma sing. My grandmother leading our extended family in song during the Jewish holidays as she waved off anyone who tried to harmonize with her when she felt like it was her time for a solo, well, that was the best part of each holiday. But that didn't mean my 11-year-old self wanted her in my living room trying to get me to help her record her songs. They would sing a song, and I would stop the tape, rewind the tape, listen to their voices, and stop the tape. Rewind again, then start the process over. I never understood this. I mean, tape recorders were fairly simple machines in the late 1970s. And these were intelligent people that fled one continent and successfully made their way to another one. At the time, I didn't understand that she didn't really need my help. She wanted me to know the songs of the Jewish diaspora. My grandmother grew up in a shtetl in Russia in the early 1900s. When she was 16, her family fled attacks by the Cossacks and got on a ship to Ellis Island. As a young teenager, her job was to strap a sewing machine on her back, walk miles to town, sew for the Gentile family during the week, and walk home for Sabbath. Family lore has it that it was on those walks that she developed her beautiful singing voice, trading songs with the Russian peasants, returning from the fields, and the Jewish and Gypsy travelers. My first year living in Wisconsin, I decided not to travel back home for Passover. One night, as I was falling asleep, I realized it would be my first Passover without my grandma leading the songs. I was surprised by how bad that made me feel. I called my mom and asked her to get a tape recorder, sit down with grandma, have her sing the Passover songs, and express mail them to me so grandma could lead the songs at my Seder in Madison. A few years later, my grandmother died. And soon after that, we digitized her tapes. A few months ago, I got one of those texts you dread getting. My mom was in heart failure, intubated in the hospital, and it was touch and go. We all rushed to be with her in the hospital. Heart failure can affect breathing, so it was hard for my mom to talk, but she could text. One night, on maybe her eighth night in the hospital, she texted me. She wanted to know if I could find those digitized recordings of her mom singing. She was scared and in pain and thought it would bring her great comfort to have her mother sing her to sleep. At that moment, so many memories flashed through my mind, but it stuck on my sitting on that shag carpet with my grandmother, holding the Sony tape recorder. And now, 40 years later, those tapes are being called into service. I thought about how my mom had been the culture bearer for the younger generations, so we don't let assimilation remove our Yiddish heritage from our lives. And I thought of my mom, frail and alone in a hospital bed, yearning to hear her mother's voice. In a flash of technological finesse I don't usually possess, within minutes, I navigated on my phone to my Google Drive, copied the link to one of the MP4s, and texted my family a recording of Grandma singing. Then we were all silent for a few minutes, in our separate houses, but still together, listening to Grandma sing.
Jen Rubin of Madison brought us that story on the Yiddish tapes. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org, on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
bringt mir mein Weibele herein.
Now, how much faith do you have in government's abilities to solve problems? Talking about federal, state, local, there is an argument that change in representation may mean less continuity and new, sometimes completely different reform agendas, and it all results in less overall government improvement. Nothing's getting better. We're talking about how governments can work more collaboratively with outside partners to be more effective and restore public confidence, ours. And our guest has some specific plans to make that happen. And we want you to join us here at 1-800-642-1234. Choose your level of government, local, state, federal. Does it have your confidence or trust? Did it ever? And what's caused you to feel better or worse, or maybe even agnostic about the people in power who are in charge or tasked with solving big problems for big groups of folks? Call us, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email always available, ideas@WPR.org. Don Kettle is a professor emeritus, former dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, and a fellow at the National Academy of Public Administration. His books include The Divided States of America and Can Governments Earn Our Trust? Well, can they? He chaired two blue ribbon commissions for Wisconsin state government, one on campaign finance reform and the other on government structure and finance. And his latest book is co-written with William Eggers. It's called Bridge Builders: How Government Can Transcend Boundaries to Solve Big Problems. Don, welcome back to Central Time.
Lee, it is so good to be with you there this afternoon.
I want to start with your optimism in the face of what is a general skepticism about government's ability to get things done. You've been at this for a long time. You've studied this more than most who have an opinion on this. So what keeps you motivated and keeps you talking about it and keeps you coming on to show how we can do it better?
Well, one of the things is it sure beats the alternative, and I'm not ready to throw in the towel yet at all. But one of the things that that both Bill Eggers and I, my co-author, are convinced of is that it's truly possible to be able to make government work better, and in particular to solve some of the really big problems that we're facing. And the reason why we wrote this book was to try to describe how the people who have figured it out have figured out how to do it better. Continually impressed by people who have been out there on the front lines and have found the solutions. And so what we've tried to do in this book, Bridge Builders, is to lay out a strategy that we've been able to be able to steal actually from the people who are actually out there doing this every day.
I want to back you up on that. Bridge Builders, your new book, is not a pie-in-the-sky theoretical design. It is actually looking at when government works and what it is, the common themes that are involved in when government is able to tackle big problems and make things better for a large population of people. So how would you define a bridge builder? Who are they and what do they look like, Don?
The bridge builders are the people who make the connections among all the different players who are responsible for providing the kind of services that we want. We've got a large number of people that we've explored and identified, but one of my favorites is Mike Nichols, who is down here in Texas in Houston, and he's the head of something called the Houston Coalition for the Homeless. And in the course of the last 5 years, they've reduced homelessness by 63%. Now, let me repeat that, 63% in 5 years. This is something that almost everybody agrees is one of the very toughest problems that we have to solve. But the way in which he did it was to try to pull together a very complex set of different kinds of organizations, more than 100 in total, and got them to work together to try to make the ways in which homelessness needs to be attacked work effectively. One of the things that we discovered as we were looking at the book is that so often we tend to think about government as a kind of vending machine where you put some money in the top and you pull the lever and you press the button for the kind of service that you want and then worry about whether or not the service is actually going to come out the other end. What we've discovered is that government is much more like a big symphony orchestra. And it's the matter of trying to find somebody who's an orchestra conductor, which often turns out to be government leaders, who find a way to bring the orchestra together. And if the biggest orchestra we've been able to find is usually about 100 different kinds of people playing 100 different kinds of instruments. But It turns out that there in Houston, they managed to create this enormous progress against homelessness with a group larger than the largest symphony orchestra. That's pretty impressive work. But in the working together, they created truly beautiful music and attacking one of society's very biggest problems.
Well, and as you ask in the book Bridge Builders, Don, what kind of a problem is homelessness? Is it economic? Is it jobs? Is it mental health, drugs, family, criminal justice? What kind of problem is this? And there's no one answer to it, so there can't be any one solution. And that's why you talk about the importance of being outcome focused and how starting with the outcome may be the best place to take your first step, even though that's what you're that's just the goal.
Well, that's exactly right. And it turns out, Lee, that increasingly the problem of accountability is not a matter of just having people check off the boxes or to try to rattle the bureaucracy from the top down and hope that we're going to be able to get something that comes out on the other end, but instead to try to look at the organization as a place where it's you bring work the kind of expertise that you need to be able to produce the results that we want. But you define accountability in terms of the entire system's ability to be able to produce the outcomes that we want. And the more that we focus on outcomes and drive everybody to those results, the more effective the system is going to be.
We want to start with reducing homelessness. That is the outcome we're going from, and we work our way back from there. Does that sound about right?
That's right. And one of the other things, too, that they did in Houston was to begin at the beginning by going out and trying to understand what are the basic problems that lead people to homelessness? And they discovered that in some cases, it's mental illness. In some cases, it's drug dependence. Other cases, it turns out to be an economic crisis, like the loss of a job. Sometimes it's being released from prison. Other times, it's a kind of a problem of spousal abuse. And so if we want to try to understand how to fix the problem, we need to understand what problem we have to fix. And then to try to identify the organizations that can be most useful and most effective at being able to produce those kind of results that we want. So it's understanding that government is not just a set of individual bureaucracies that are not connected, but a set of very complex problems we're trying to solve, and where the key is trying to understand how we can bring all the different organizations together that are responsible, that are needed for trying to attack these problems.
Don Kettle, Professor Emeritus, former Dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, joining us. His new book, which he co-authors with William Eggers, is Bridge Builders, How Government Can Transcend Boundaries to Solve Big Problems. Join us, 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the solutions that our guest is offering and how government might work better for the lot of us? Do you work in government? Are you a public leader? Do you see yourself as a bridge builder, or do you see other bridge builders out there who deserve attention for the work they're doing? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and we're picking up our conversation about helping governments figure out how to better solve today's complex problems. And it involves a complicated solution, according to our guest, which brings in all parties who are invested and involved and can come out and are outcome focused. Don Kettle's Professor Emeritus and former Dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. He's the co-author of the new book, Bridge Builders, How Government Can Transcend Boundaries and to Solve Big Problems. I want to talk about trust, Don, and how we build trust in government at a time when trust can be seen as a near nadir.
That's a great question, Lee. And the core problem is that, truth be told, most of us really don't trust the government very much to do what it is that needs to be done, and especially at the big level, what we call in the book the wholesale level of politics. And it's very hard to try to trust a government where we see such incredible polarization. But on the other hand, one of the things that we've discovered is that on the retail level, on the way that each of us interacts with the kind of government agencies that are responsible for delivering the goods and services that we want, what we really want is to have our problems solved. We don't really care who solves them, in fact. We just, if we have a problem, want the problem solved. And the more that we can focus on those problems, the more that we can develop good solutions, the more we can bring together the different organizations that contribute to those solutions, and the more that we can satisfy all of us about the kinds of services that we're getting, to that degree, we can really truly improve service and improve trust in government. I think it's going to be really tough to change it at the wholesale level because there are such huge battles that go back and forth. But at the retail level, that is, at the level where each of us interacts with the government, the more that we can improve service by making sure that fires are put out, to make sure that the snow is removed from the roads, the more that we can try to deal with those issues of homelessness that we were talking about earlier, the more that we can make government work well at the retail level, to that degree, we can build trust one brick at a time in the wall that really constitutes our democracy and the kind of buildings that we use to try to establish the way in which we want government to serve us. And that's something that is fundamentally important. And the good news that we discovered in this book, Bridge Builders, is that it's something that is very doable when we get the right kinds of people in the right places and the right skills to get the job done.
Complex problems would require the government to bring in all parties involved and come up with some complex solutions. So how do you assign accountability that can restore or invest in trust when you have all these parties involved in dealing with and looking for these outcomes?
And that's one of the toughest problems of all. When we start talking about a government that doesn't seem accountable, what it really means too often is that it looks like we've got government agencies that too often are just in business for themselves. But the way to try to bring all of these different organizations together and to define what accountability means is to focus on those outcomes, to focus on what it is that we want the system to do, and then to judge whether or not it's doing it. And one of the things that we've discovered is that one of the easiest way to break down those walls that too often are put up between government agencies is to focus everybody's attention not on process and not on programs and not on who's in control and who's in charge, but rather what kind of problems that we need to solve and who it is that has the assets that we need to solve individual parts of the problem. But the great realization that has come over most of us, I think, is that we're now in a world where there's no one problem that any one organization can control. And that's true. It's not going to change. And so the way to solve problems is not to try to control them, but rather to try to identify who can contribute which pieces to the outcomes that we want to try to produce. And it's making those different pieces work together that creates this kind of symphony that has to constitute the way in which government operates these days.
Don Kettle, our guest. He is a co-author along with William Eggers of the new book, Bridge Builders, How Government Can Transcend Boundaries to Solve Big Problems. And Don, I imagine that good government types would be nodding along with just about everything you have to say today. So what are the impediments here? Where do you see the barriers to getting done a government that provides for better outcomes?
Well, and the good news on the one side is that as we've talked to lots of government officials and lots of people on the inside, you're right, we do get a lot of head nods. We get people saying, yeah, this is the way in which things have to be done. But why is it, if it makes so much sense, that it's so hard to do? And the answer is that in some cases, we've got people who don't want to play along. We've got organizations that want to try to defend their boundaries as if there were barbed wire and deep trenches to make sure nobody could come in. We've got people who are jealous about their own individual power and guarding the money that they've got. We know all of these impediments that unfortunately have built up over the years.
Yeah, so Don, it sounds like
what we also know is that we've got ways to be able to solve them.
Well, I was going to say, it sounds like we're going to have to overcome human nature to the way you describe these problems.
Well, you know, on the one hand, it's the kind of organizational pathology that goes way, 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 way back. But on the other hand, we have a kind of basic philosophy undergirding most of what we're talking about here, which is that most people, when they go to work for a government agency or for any organization, really don't want to say, let me go to work today and see if I can really screw this up. Instead, what people want to do is go and find a way to get their job done.
Yes.
And what we found is that there are strong and effective ways of solving these problems. And it's in many ways just sweeping the barriers out of the way so that they can do what we want them to do and what they want to do.
Don Kelly, you talked earlier about homelessness and how Houston has tackled that and reduced the homeless population with a number of bridge builders like Mike Nichols and bringing in a number of different organizations who are invested in the outcome. With the 2 minutes we have left, can you briefly talk about the biggest thing we're going to have to tackle here in climate change and how we even get started on dealing with something like that?
Now, that's just a great example of a problem that we know that we need to solve and which none of us can solve on our own. And so the key is first to try to sit and understand what is it that we're trying to accomplish? What are the steps along the way? What are the kind of targets that we can set so we can understand whether or not we're going to make any difference? Then we have to understand who is in charge of doing what, so that we can begin to assign responsibility to all the players, whether it's those of us who drive cars and finding cars that are more efficient, those of us who are designing mass transit systems to get more people off the roads and into more fuel efficient vehicles, and to try to look more fundamentally at the basic issues that would help us to try to clean up the production and factories and manufacturing facilities to make that cleaner as well. It's a matter of breaking the problem down, finding out what it is that we need to do to accomplish the results that we want, to be able to hold each of us accountable for those individual pieces, and use that to try to put all those pieces together to create the results that we want.
And Don, finish where we start here with a few 30 seconds we have left. What keeps you optimistic that we can get there from here?
Well, the best news of all is that I spent lots and lots and lots of time with people who are actually out there doing this. And while on the one hand, we all see these horrific news stories often that talk about the lack of accountability and government's poor performance problems, we've seen far more often as we start looking the stories of people who are actually doing a great job, who have figured out how to crack these problems, who have go to work every day and find solutions, whether they're small pieces or even in very big ones, like Admiral Thad Allen, who succeeded in finding ways of trying to battle against the problems that came up with Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans.
Don Kettle, will have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today. Now, coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we're talking about what couples of all kinds can learn from the unique strengths that are found in LGBTQ relationships. We'll look at the science. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time. Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Biden signed the debt ceiling bill into law over the weekend, and we'll talk to a Wisconsin Republican and a Wisconsin Democratic representative about why they voted for and against the legislation. First, June is Pride Month, and the LGBTQ community has a lot to be proud of. Despite facing cultural stigma, LGBTQ relationships have unique strengths, strengths that we can all integrate into our own relationships, no matter how we identify or no matter who we love. Our next guest is a counselor that specializes in LGBTQ relationships. She's here in the studio to talk about what she's observed in her practice and what we know from existing research. And you can join us with your questions, your comments, and your experiences. The phone number, 1-800-642-1234. What are some strengths and challenges of LGBTQ relationships that you found in your experiences, in your relationships? If you're straight, what relationship questions do you have for LGBTQ couples? Join us. 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Gina Senarigi is a Wisconsin-based author, sexuality counsel, and relationship coach. And Gina, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. This is exciting. Happy Pride.
Happy Pride to you, too. And I want to start with the research and what the science says. And you spoke about this in your recent podcast, Swoon, Love Lessons with Julia and Gina. You're the Gina mm-hmm. part of that. What does research say about the unique relationship experiences of queer couples?
Yeah, well, it's actually kind of exciting. And I find it, as a queer person myself, really validating that there is, frankly, a lot of research coming out showing the strengths of our relationships in a world that where a lot of people misunderstand our relationships or have judgments about how we structure them or a lot of assumptions and misinformation about how we do love, to have actual research, most of it right now coming out of the Relationship Research Institute. That's John and Julie Gottman. They're really famous couples therapists and researchers. That really looks at, okay, comparatively, what do we know about LGBTQ relationships and how they differ from straight or heterosexual relationships? And they found several several elements that are really key strengths. One of them, do you want me to just launch into them?
Well, I'm curious about what makes these relationships different from heteronormative relationships and why we're finding that there are strengths there that wouldn't necessarily find a given in straight couples.
Yeah. Well, so their relationship research has been mostly on same-sex or same-gender couples. So that's folks who identify as two men or two women. They're not doing research on polyamorous relationships. They haven't done a ton yet on relationships with trans-identified folks or transgender-identified folks. So we're looking at gay men and lesbians mostly. But they've been publishing research on LGBT relationships since 2017. And one of the elements that's really strong is our ability to navigate conflict successfully. What they find is that our resiliency comes in a couple of different ways. One, we show more affection throughout conflict. So there might be, even though we're arguing or disagreeing about something, we're likely to make appropriate jokes, not necessarily like spiteful jokes or something, but we're able to bring some levity and some humor into conflict. We're more likely to show physical affection while navigating conflict. So, holding a partner's hand while talking about something really difficult, rubbing someone's back while we're talking about something difficult can be really soothing and helps you navigate conflict with greater sense of connection, right? Yeah. We're also less likely to take things personally in conflict. And so, the times when maybe there's a misunderstanding and it feels like it's got a barb.
I'm being attacked.
Right. We're more likely to say, oh, is that really about me? Or is that even subconsciously, is that really about me personally? Or is that just, this person's bringing me information? And because of that, we're less likely to get escalated in a conflict or feel really insecure about ourselves throughout it, get less defensive. And that's usually when conflicts take a pretty ugly turn, is when you're feeling defensive and insecure. Or I am.
And some of these is conflict navigation sounds like it brings relationships closer, has a tendency to bring couples closer, as opposed to instead of reaching out, withholding, and as opposed to pulling back and lack of any sort of physical or interpersonal contact, turning away from conflict, but actually leaning into it.
Yeah. And it's not like LGBT relationships are perfect. It's not like there's no conflict no issue there. But what we see in the research is that we're able to navigate it more successfully and stay connected, take it less personal. Those are factors that help us move through the conflict, which is a natural part of any relationship, gay or straight.
Right? It should be in a healthy one. But what is it that for gay or lesbian couples that makes them more inclined towards healthier conflict navigation?
What I think that hasn't fully been published yet. So Dr. Brené Brown got pretty famous for a while there about working through shame and shame resilience and what vulnerability and shame looks like. And what she would say is that shame is a natural part of any human being, right? Like it's going to come up. And shame is this idea that some part of me is unworthy of love, is unworthy of belonging, right? And as a queer person or an LGBTQ person in society, there's a lot of messages that say something's wrong with you out there. There's a lot of people who would tell us that. And so in order to be an out member of this community, you have to build some shame resilience. You have to be able to say, I'm worthy of love and belonging, even if somebody else has these ideas about me. And then that transfers. This is, I think that transfers into the conversation we have with a partner, right? Where we're less likely less likely. Now, it's not, we're not impermeable to shame, right? Like, it's part of truly human condition.
Yes.
We're humans. But we're able to navigate through that a little bit more successfully as well, where we're less likely to say, I am broken or unlovable, and more likely to say, okay, this situation's really hard, or we're both really stressed out, or these are the factors that are coming to play here, instead of saying, oh, I'm terrible or you're a bad guy, right?
So the shame resilience can aid and support healthier conflict navigation. Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. When I trained with Brené Brown, I asked her, you know, it sounds a lot like shame and oppression go hand in hand. How does she see them as the same? And she said she loves a Venn diagram with her response. And she was like, they are not the same thing, but they work together and they often overlap. And so folks who have been able to navigate in an oppressive context successfully are also likely to navigate shame more successfully. And shame, you know, builds depression and disconnection mm-hmm. in all kinds of ways.
Gina Senarigi, our guest, Wisconsin-based author, sexuality counselor, and relationship coach. And you can join our conversation with your questions, your experiences at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Gina, what have you observed in working with LGBTQ couples in your own work, in your own counseling? What do you see?
I mean, I do see the factors that have been that have come up in the research. One of the things that that we don't always think about, but it's very true, is that in heterosexual couples, there's a lot of socialization that sets us up to think, okay, you're the man in the relationship, you do these things, I'm the woman in the relationship, I do these things. And we don't always even think about it. We don't always even realize, like, oh, somehow I ended up being the one who schedules all of our playdates and manages our social calendar. And I didn't even realize that's like a woman's job in a relationship. But somehow we end up there, right? Like, I see couples all the time who end up in these roles and just are like, how do we get here? Something doesn't feel great, but we don't know how to adjust it or even identify it. And for same-sex couples, we have to look at, like, okay, you weren't socialized to do this thing and I wasn't, or we both were. How do we want to distribute household tasks? How do we want to manage responsibilities in a thoughtful way, usually based on our strengths or our interests, rather than just because you have to, because you're the guy, or I feel like I have to I'm a woman.
This is the social norm of it all. This is the way it's always been done. But in LGBTQ couples, lesbian and gay couples, those norms have to be decided.
Yeah. I mean, the lawn still needs to get mowed, right? In our household, somebody has to figure out the
no
bus
default.
Schedule.
There's no, this is the way it's always been done. So the inertia says this is how we're going to do it.
Mm-hmm. And so we're inclined to talk about it some and better equipped to navigate, like, oh, huh, somehow we just fell into this pattern, but it's not working. How do we got to change it. Right. You're getting grumpy because you're the one always doing our taxes and I don't like taking the car into the shop.
You're
right?
Going to communicate that grumpiness? Well, this is enlightening. We're talking to Gina Senarigi, Wisconsin-based author, sexuality counselor and relationship coach, about the unique strengths of LGBTQ relationships and what couples of all kinds can learn from them. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Do you follow societal expectations and the gender norms in your own relationships? How do you divide the labor in your household? And has that caused some tension in your couple? What do you do differently from other couples that you know? Let us know. 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue our conversation with Gina coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and we're picking up our conversation about the unique strengths of LGBTQ relationships, strengths that all types of couples can strive towards. Gina Senarigi is a Wisconsin-based author, sexuality counselor, and relationship coach. You can find her online at heygina.com, and we want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. Have you been in both LGBT and non-LGBT relationships, and what was similar or different about those relationships in your experience?
experiences. What other questions would you have for our guest this afternoon? 1-800-642-1234. And Gina, I want to ask about communicating intimacy and how we talk about being intimate together, and how that is different for LGBTQ couples compared to heteronormative couples.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there are a couple of key differences, and they're different based on the particular identity of the folks in the couple. But what we do know is that if you identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, panqueer, you're likely to have come up against something along in your life that says, oh, the standard normalized heterosexual way of relating in relationships doesn't fit for me either. Like, something as simple as like, I like to initiate kisses a certain way, or I don't care for kissing someone with a mustache, or I really do. Something very similar might be, we come up against that at some point in our life and have to kind of grapple with that, and then are likely to play around with some of the specifics of like, oh, actually, I'm going to tailor my sexual experience in these ways, or I'm going to seek out these experiences, right? We have to get to know that in a more intimate way than our culture usually supports heterosexual people figuring it out. Usually we teach people this is how sex works, and then we kind of think that works for everyone. Turns out, I mean, I've been a sex therapist, doesn't really work for a lot of people, but that's for another show. we can come back another time. As a queer person, you have to realize, you have to come to understanding some about your own sexuality and then be able to say that to a partner. I like to be touched this way more than that way, or I prefer this act rather than that act. And so we end up building strength along the way. Now, again, this doesn't apply to every LGBT person in the world. We certainly do experience sexual traumas and all the same issues that lead to complications in talking about sexuality. But because we have to figure out, which are the pieces that align for me and which pieces don't, we tend to get better at communicating that with partners. Gay men especially, in the research, are shown to communicate a lot more directly and clearly about their sexual needs. And we can make a lot of inferences about why that might be around them being socialized or them learning to navigate the world. But it's a great strength when you can say to a partner, this is what I like.
And what we could all take from that is to know yourself and what your gas pedal, and you talked about this with Julie on your podcast, Swoon, what your gas pedal and what your brakes are, and being able to express that to anybody else that you're going to get in the car with.
Yeah. What are your turn-ons and turn-offs, and how are they unique to you? Because every person has a unique set of them. And amazingly, partners aren't mind readers. So if you tell them what those things are, they're more likely to do them or figure out how to do them.
And that might be a little more rewarding than trial and error, per se.
or not talking about it at all, which is the norm.
And ending up someplace where you are not comfortable and... Yeah.
Yeah, or just thinking you're doing a great job when you're not.
This raises a lot more questions, but they're a lot more interpersonal in nature and probably not for the larger broadcast, Gina.
Might be a different time of day interview. Yeah.
But, LGBTQ couples experience challenges, and are those challenges as unique as some of their strengths?
Yeah, there are some. I mean, there definitely is one that we're seeing more research coming out, which is that there's this whole field of research called attachment theory. It's been pretty popular in some mainstream literature about relationships lately. But the bottom line is attachment theory talks about how we develop intimate, trusting partnerships and how we really believe that somebody's there for us, right?
Love.
There's a lot that we learn in our early life relationships and our families. Our whole life kind of sets us up for certain attachment styles. And, what we learn over the lifespan is people who have more experiences where As I'm building a relationship with you, I'm vulnerable. And then I feel like you're making eye contact right now. Like, oh, you're there for me, right? So there's a moment of I'm learning, and my little brain gets to learn, oh, I can trust in this scenario, right? Or eye contact feels good, right? This person's listening to me. I also will collect many experiences that tell me that trusting isn't safe. People won't have your back. People might betray you. You don't belong. You're not lovable. Like, those are the messages that come up. And in a society that doesn't support LGBTQ relationships or people as fully as it needs to, lots of people walk away with what we're calling like a gay attachment trauma is one of the ways I've heard it framed, LGBT attachment trauma, right? You think about how many people are kicked out of their churches or their families growing up. That is a huge attachment wound, right? The messages that they take away subconsciously can be don't trust people. Don't be vulnerable.
And it's not just take away, but bring to every relationship that they walk into.
Yeah. And so the result is we tend to feel, and this has shown up in the Gottman's research out of 2017, that we feel less entitled to long-term successful love. And if you think about even for, I'm not that old, I'm in my mid-40s. I lived most of my life without gay marriage being legal. I had a marriage that I had a few weddings to the same person each time. Marriage was legalized in different states, but that is the governmental structure saying, is my relationship valid, real, or true, right? And I watched gay marriage become legalized. That's one way that we validate these are valuable relationships. These are healthy adults. And there's a ton of us out here. It's not been legal that long. It was only 2015, right? So, there's a ton of people with some attachment wounding about, is my relationship valid in the larger society, right? I'm curious to see over time, we're seeing people come out younger and younger. Gen Z has a wide acceptance of LGBTQ relationships. I'm curious to see how this might shift over time.
And in terms of attachment.
Yeah, we're seeing more and more parents support their kids who are coming out, which is wonderful.
And might reduce or minimize the traumas that would be brought into these relationships. I'm curious from your experiences as a sexuality counselor, relationship coach, Gina, how can we teach healthy attachment? How can we pass this along to others, our family, our kids? How can we leave them with less trauma?
Yeah. Wow. How much time do I have to?
About 2 minutes.
Okay, great. Yeah, because that's like a whole master's degree right there. what we can do is think about how we are being reliable resources for the people we love and care about, where we might drop the ball, because any one of us is going to drop the ball. I can look over to you, or I can say something to you in conversation, and you might get distracted like any normal human does. And so I might miss that eye contact for a minute. Our job as we're building intimate relationships is to say, oh, hey, I missed you over. I think you were trying to, can I be here for you now, right? To do a little repair, and then to try and really be aware of the ways that we're connecting and showing up in reliable ways in relationship.
Does that have to do with repairing our own traumas before we bring it into other relationships?
Again, how many, I could be here all day talking about this, but really it is, we're likely to replicate some of the patterns that we experience. So if you experienced family members who weren't there for you consistently, you haven't necessarily learned how to show up for others consistently and reliably. And you know, if we bring it back to queer relationships and community, one of the things that we see is that there tends to be a strong community support around our relationships. That is another strength of ours, partially because so many folks have bonded as a result of their attachment trauma from their families or from their church or from their high school that kicked them out for being trans or whatever. So we tend to build really strong social bonds, and those often do nourish our relationships.
Gina, happy Pride Month.
Happy Pride.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And you can find more of Gina online at heygina.com. Her podcast is Swoon. That is Love Lessons with Julie and Gina. And her book, Love More, Fight Less, Communication Skills Every Couple Needs, a Relationship Workbook for Couples. Gina Senarighi joining us this afternoon, Wisconsin-based author, sexuality counselor, and relationship coach, talking with us about the particular strengths of LGBTQ relationships and what we can all learn from them. Coming up after the news, Wisconsin Democratic Representative Gwen Moore will join us to explain why she voted against the bill to raise the debt ceiling, and Wisconsin Republican Representative Brian Stile will follow to share his reasons for voting in favor of the legislation. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.